Hi, I'm Umushu.
And I'm Lindsay Claiborne, and you're listening to Beyond the Microscope.
Hi everyone, this is Lindsay and Mumu back here for another episode of Beyond the Microscope. Today's guest is Nicole Brokema, who is a postdoctoral research fellow.
Hey Nicole, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
I'm currently a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard Medical School, and I work on studying how herpes virus interacts with the cells that it infects and how it escapes immune detection in those cells.
What are you looking at? Are you looking at the virus as a whole? Are you looking at one particular part of it? How micro are you on this topic?
So I do very basic science research right now. So what that means is I'm very detailed looking, interested in one protein that the virus makes and how that one protein is inhibiting a host cell sensor of herpes viral DNA in the cell.
And what does that mean for someone who gets infected with herpes? What are you researching that then, what's the follow through on that?
Herpes is sort of what I would call a complicated virus. It makes hundreds of proteins. So all of these proteins have evolved to limit different aspects of either immune detection or help make more viruses. Basically, so in a virus that's infecting out in the population, this protein is already intact, helping the virus escape detection, helping the virus get into the cell and develop a persistent infection.
So it's like a defensive mechanism for this virus.
Yeah.
It's one of its... Okay.
Exactly. So there's a lot of different mechanisms that the virus does. So generally, like a lot of these host cell virus interactions, people describe them as an arms race because they're always trying to evolve to counter each other.
So in terms of what you do and the herpes virus,
there is a new sensor described just 2 years ago that I work on, and no one's described a viral, we call them antagonists. So like in literature, you know, there's a protagonist and an antagonist. So
right.
In virology, we call them antagonists. So no one's described a viral antagonist for this protein yet.
And is that what you're looking for?
Or yes,
are you?
Exactly.
Ooh,
so I'm trying.
That's kind of exciting.
Yeah. So I'm trying to find the first viral antagonist of this protein. I mean, it's very, you know, small scale, really delving deep into one protein and the one protein it inhibits. You know, it's very narrow for a field.
So it like if you're taking, I mean, this is a journalism term, but the inverted pyramid, right? You start with the biggest stuff, move down to the bottom. Well, we're starting at the bottom of that triangle to figure something else to build on top
right,
of.
Right, and you don't know exactly what you're going to do.
Exactly, yeah. So it's very narrow, but there's always translational, is what the biology field would call it, impacts that may or may not be apparent when you start doing the work. So, for example, many of these sensors that we've talked about, the DNA sensors, can, for lack of a better term, go haywire in your own cells. So they might start to recognize your own DNA as foreign and you'll get autoimmune diseases. So possibly if we could identify how these sensors work at their most basic level, we can try and figure out ways to turn them off when it's bad for you and it might be causing a disease.
Here's this may be asking for it in terms of technical language, but how do you do this? How, I mean, you're not just like poking at it. I mean, what do you do on a daily basis to try to find this antagonist for this this thing?
Well, so the lab that I'm currently in is really uniquely positioned to try and answer these questions. We have what's been described as an arsenal of mutated viruses. So
in this arms race, we
have
an arsenal.
So exactly.
This is going to be the podcast of military analogies.
Yes. Sorry, there's a lot of military analogies. But
keep using them. I like it. Keep it coming.
But basically, my... my advisor has been in the field for so long, and people over the years have made all these different mutants and each of these different components of the virus. So now when I'm interested, I know that, or I really have to have sort of an inkling, or you have to stumble across something to start to research it. But I had an idea that these sensors, the specific sensor, might be inhibited because we weren't seeing activation of the pathway that it induces. So now I can go through the arsenal that we have of viruses. It's kind of a tedious process to try and do it this way, but basically look at if one of my mutated viruses now activates that pathway, that means that the component that was mutated is involved in inhibiting the pathway. So it's a really backwards sort of way of looking at things. But because we have access to all of these mutants, we can sort of get at these questions using that.
So you're like Professor X from X-Men.
I don't think I would describe it that way, but yeah, there's a lot of mutants in what I do.
All right, now this may come across as, for someone who studies viruses, as an obvious or dumb question, but are viruses very similar on the whole and then they each have their own unique characteristic, or are they extremely different? Are they vastly different and you can't really compare one to another?
There are huge differences. So, and I'm trying to think of, like, the only common thing that viruses are described to have in common is that they don't have ribosomes, which means they can't translate their own proteins. I mean, that's very technical, but basically there are viruses that come in with almost nothing more than just their own, like, DNA or RNA and use the host cell for everything. And there are huge viruses that come in with almost everything that a cell has, and they're, you know, basically as big as some bacteria. But so there's just this huge spectrum of what viruses do to cells, but they need a host cell to complete their viral life cycle or to make more viruses.
Studying what you study and these sort of security systems of the cells, what is it that we on the whole want, would be able to use this for? Is this like coming up with preventative medicines or vaccines for these viruses? Is that the sort of end result, is figuring out how they work so we can get to the other side of it? What's the sort of broadest, biggest end goal?
Yeah, I think you could either, you could sort of think of end goals on both the virus and the host, or on the cell side. So this could help us, the more we understand about how viruses replicate, the better we can possibly design vaccines. So another project in our lab is to use viruses that can't replicate in your cells and use them as vaccines. So they still make a lot of these components or proteins that activate our immune system. And then that is able to help us create a better immune response or vaccine to HSV. But you could also think about it from the host cell side. If we understand how these sensors work, we can again try and turn them off or limit them in cases, in situations where they're activated when there's no pathogen present. So again, like I said, there, these autoimmune diseases, there's a lot of different ones, but some of them are when these sensors start to recognize your own DNA, and they'll set off these pathways that alert neighboring cells and recruit all these factors, and then you get basically disease. Because I guess I should back up and say that a lot of what you consider disease from a virus in many cases is actually just you responding to the virus.
It's your body's reaction
exactly.
to it, or it's is it confusion? Is it misinterpretation? What is it, intentional?
No. Yeah, none of this is intentional. So sometimes, you know, we assign sort of anthropomorphized viruses or cells. None of it's intentional. It's just an overreaction. And some people are more prone to it, depending on, you know, differences in different people. You know, different people respond differently to the same pathogen.
So I have a question. Viruses are so effective in sort of their destructiveness.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. Oh, let me try this again.
Okay.
Viruses actually, let's go back to your email said something about they're effective or efficiently something.
Oh, I called them exquisitely efficient.
Ooh, I like that phrase.
Is there any way for us...
Wait, can we go back? What does that mean?
So what I liked about some of the
viruses...
Not all viruses. So some of these most recent viruses that have been discovered are what we call giant viruses, which are really complicated and basically have everything that a cell would have. But one of the viruses that I studied in graduate school actually only makes 6 proteins, and it has a tiny genome. So what I like about that is I think that's a very efficient use of space. It, like, you can't add anything to it. You can't subtract anything from it without it just, the whole system just failing. It has evolved to be exactly the size it needs to be, no more, no less. So, it just has these 6 proteins, and it uses them, to go through its whole life cycle. And it's a very, successful virus.
Exquisitely efficient.
I would call it successful because it approximately 80 or 90% of the population is infected with it. And almost no one knows what this virus is, even though almost everyone has it, because it doesn't actually cause disease in most people, which is actually, more successful outcome for the virus if you anthropomorphize it and think about it like that. Like, you, as a virus, you don't necessarily want to. I'm using want in quotes because, again, none of this is want. But it's not necessarily beneficial for you to kill your host or even to cause, like, overt disease symptoms because, again, that might cause an evolutionary response where people avoid the sick people so that you don't get as much spread. So these viruses that really operate below the radar are sort of more successful pathogens, even though they don't necessarily cause as much disease.
Is there a way to use that to our advantage? I mean, maybe we don't understand quite how that mechanism works for those viruses to be so effective, but if we were to understand that, could we take that and develop a good virus that, you know, can spread through the air, that can, you know, essentially cure cancer or something equally amazing?
Yeah, so a lot of people are using viruses as vectors. Well, I guess the most common thing they're used for right now is gene therapy. So you'd put a gene, so a person may have a mutated gene so they can't make something, and I went to a talk the other day about a specific mutation that causes blindness. So you put in that the genetic information for that gene into a virus and you infect the person, and it now the virus will make that protein in the correct form for you, and it can even restore vision. So a lot of people are working on these things, either using viruses that we already know to benefit you as a as these gene therapy vectors, or the other thing that I should say is that not all viruses are necessarily bad. So it's easy to recognize some, like, microbes when they're bad, when they're causing disease. That's why all of the bacteria and viruses and parasites that were initially discovered are all disease-causing agents. But what's coming out now, especially in the bacteriology field, with all the microbiome stuff, I'm sure you've heard about probiotics, is that there are good bacteria. And I'm pretty sure, I don't have specific examples to tell you about right now, but there are going to be examples of good viruses.
Well, I would say that, like, if somebody says, oh, well, I work with viruses, the automatic reaction is, like, hazmat suits and
Ebola,
end of days, and Ebola and measles outbreak and all, like, just crises. And I think it's sort of important to think about how that's hardly, I mean, what's the, maybe you know this or not, what's the percentage of sort of disease-causing viruses versus the number of viruses that we know about on the whole? I would assume it's a small percentage, right?
Yeah, I think that's hard to say, because...
because we don't know, right?
I don't have a number on that percentage of viruses that may be disease-causing agents. I think that good viruses is sort of even way more new of a field than the good bacteria sort of field. So I don't know that people have even tried to quantify that, but there are, I think we're only looking at a fraction of the viruses out there is what we know to exist.
Now, Mumu, what was your question before I rudely interrupted about exquisitely efficient?
That was actually, it turned out better this way, because my question was about, was there a way to use that to our advantage for good ones? So I actually wanted to ask the question because... Have either of you read Ender's Game?
Yes.
Yes.
So in one of the sequels to Ender's Game, it gets more philosophical and they go on, it's set way in the future and they're in this other planet. And
Should we say spoiler alert? In case
oh, right. Sorry, spoiler alert, guys.
Okay, continue.
Sorry, I spoiled it for you. So they're set in the future, they're on this planet, and the human species ends up encountering this other species, and the species is essentially a virus, and the virus infects these humans and other animals on the planet and sort of transforms them. So the humans end up finding out that they can take that virus and they can change certain things in the virus, and they can cure OCD essentially from this race of people on another planet.
Mm. I don't think I read that one.
So I just, yeah, sorry, that was a major spoiler alert, guys. But I was just wondering if that was sort of possible, if that was on, you know, anyone's radar screen, but
No, yeah, it's definitely theoretically possible. I mean, again, there's going to be limitations on what kind of things you can cure and where the virus replicates, you know, and if you can get your gene of interest in there, you know, certain viruses are more able to handle insertions of large proteins.
Speaking of research, you mentioned that your lab that you work in now is sort of perfectly equipped for what you do now. What does that mean? Like, do you have special technology? Is there certain machinery? What is that? How does that work?
I guess even to probably biologists, we would be considered sort of an old school lab. So we make mutants like the old-fashioned way, which is probably too complicated to
What's
go.
What's the new way? And is there a way to make mutants old-fashioned and new-fashioned? This is intriguing.
Yeah, I would like Wolverine, please.
So, there's this new, I guess it's not new anymore, but the new hot thing in gene editing is CRISPR. So it's an acronym, but
I feel like I've heard about this. Actually.
Yeah. So it's really it's a great example of something that was considered what you would probably consider just very basic science research. It's a mechanism that bacteria have to sort of chop up and recognize foreign DNA. So when bacteria sense this foreign DNA, they're able to recognize it and they just basically like cut it. At a certain point, what people realized after they discovered this system is that this had huge implications for all research fields in biology. So people are now using CRISPR to do what's called gene editing in the human genome in cell lines. People are doing it in mouse models. There's probably primate work, although I'm not familiar with that. And we can use it in our viruses.
Is there, you're talking about the new technology and new methods. Is there something that you're really excited about? I mean, you mentioned that you're sort of working on this one antagonist that nobody's found yet. Is that sort of the goal, to find it yourself? And what is it that you're sort of looking forward to that makes what you're doing exciting or interesting to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, the cool thing about going to work as a microbiologist or a scientist is that theoretically you're the first person to know something. So you're the first person to know that there's this protein that inhibits your sensor, or, you know, you're the first person to understand how the sensor is able to recognize the viral DNA. Sometimes you get into situations where you may get scooped, we call it. So if somebody else,
I know that feeling.
Yeah, if somebody else publishes something similar enough to your work before you do, we call it getting scooped.
Just like in journalism.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I feel like I've been there before.
Yeah.
Anyway, continue.
But there's, I mean, the goal isn't to just go to work and try things that other people have already tried. Sometimes you use techniques that other people have used and you sort of try and change them or look at them in a new system. But the way to make advances, I think this may not answer your question directly, is to just sort of feel like you have no idea what you're doing on any given day. Because I feel like then you're really in a new field, and you have the potential to actually make interesting discoveries. If you go to work and you know what you're doing every day, I don't think that you're a very good biologist, because you're not asking the right questions.
No, it's true, though. I mean, there's a certain part where a lot of science is sort of rehashing or reaffirming what we already know.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the other part, which is pushing frontiers or boundaries or adding to the knowledge that we already have.
Yeah, and you're not always going to be able to make huge advances. Most of the advances you make, like, the public would consider them very small, but to you, who've been working on them for years, you know, they feel big, even if they're small advances.
That's kind of the, you know, that's kind of the beauty of being, you know, in academia or being in research, is that you kind of go into work and you get to discover things that you might not have known about. And it's kind of, we sort of lose that in the atmosphere that we have now, where we're constantly looking for grant money and writing proposals and doing these things where we're, you know, you kind of lose that sort of
the wonder,
the atmosphere of, exactly. I'm just going to go in and try something. And then if it doesn't happen. But if it does, it's wonderful and great. But mm-hmm. That's just me on my soapbox pedestal.
And you'd be surprised how many advances come out of just huge mistakes.
So here's the you're at a cocktail party question, and somebody says, oh, what do you do? How do you describe what you do?
Yeah, I guess I normally start with, I work on herpes. And then occasionally people will start asking me about herpes. Very specific questions about disease, which is always kind of interesting.
And then you say you might need to go see your doctor. This is not
exactly. I'm not a real medical
I'm not that kind of doctor.
Yes.
Exactly. You'd be surprised at how often that actually happens.
I've had friends ask me about their pets before, and I said, not only am I not a medical doctor, I'm not a veterinarian either.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes. Well, you know, pets and drones. I mean, they're sort of one and the same, right?
Maybe. Yeah.
So I guess I do. I was excited to switch to a virus that people have heard of. So most of the time, I do start out by saying I work on herpes. And I guess it would just depend. I would say how I work on.
You just leave it at herpes and just walk away.
Sometimes.
I work on the herpes virus. I'm done.
Mic drop.
I just might say something about how it prevents the cell from recognizing when it's there infecting the cell.
Well, so speaking of cocktail parties, we hear you have a joke, your go-to joke when they stop asking you for medical advice.
Oh, okay. Yeah. What's the difference between true love and herpes? Herpes is forever.
Oh, no. Oh, that's wonderful and terrible
exactly.
At the same time.
So I don't know if that's too bad to use.
No, that is very appropriate for us, I think.
I love it. But let's go back to the scary headline scenario. What's the doomsday scenario that's most realistic or that you're most worried about?
So like if I could contrast like measles versus Ebola, I think because there are two, you know, sort of recent-ish outbreaks in the news that are getting a lot of attention slash got a lot of attention. I would say measles is the more realistic concern for the general population of the United States. So it doesn't have the scary high mortality that Ebola does, but what it does have is scary high transmission rates. So the low mortality that it causes is sort of offset by the sheer number of people that it can infect with ease. So
we just saw that happen.
Exactly. I mean, just imagine if the vaccination rates were even lower, you'd have just massive spread. So that's why it's really important to have high vaccination rates, which result in what we call herd immunity. So it's where the majority of the population is immune so that the chances of the virus coming in contact with a not immune person are fairly low. So you are able to limit spread.
Because there are people that can't, for some reason, actually get the vaccine, whether they're allergic to it or they have another medical condition that means it's a problem.
Exactly. Or there's even just very, very young children, so infants. You know, there's an age at which you can start being vaccinated. So, and actually it's most deadly in the very, very young. So even just before you're able to start vaccinating your infants, that's the ones that are most important to protect. And the only way to do that is by having those around them be protected.
Do you think there is a misconception about viruses in the public?
Yeah, I think that it seems that the news just sort of overblows everything. and there's a lot of this, like, you know, sometimes it seems like it's just like, be afraid of measles, Ebola, everything. So I don't necessarily think it's a misconception so much as it's sort of what's presented to people oftentimes. Or how it's presented sometimes. I mean, and not all news, but some of the media outlets.
Well, we use the saying that if it bleeds, it leads, right?
Exactly.
And that sounds awful, but it's true. I mean, the more scary or dramatic or sort of severe, the more likely it is to work as a headline news story.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, measles and, you know, spreading whatever, like viruses, is epidemics is scary,
and it
you know, especially when it's in your own country and at Disneyland.
Yes.
Yeah. I always get calls from my mother after these news stories telling me not to lick anything when I go out in public. So
I think that's just good advice generally.
I mean,
well, the scary thing about measles is that you don't even have to go lick anything. It's actually one of the most transmissible or easy to catch viruses known. If you go into a room of somebody that there was a contagious person in, even like a couple hours before, you can still get the virus just by being in that room.
Ooh. Oh, don't tell your mother, Mimo.
No. Mandatory.
When we talk about viruses, we talk about infection and mortality rates. Like the recent Ebola outbreak had mortality rates in the 70s or higher, right?
Yeah, and it depends on, again, Ebola was, if you had medical intervention, it's actually much lower. So it seemed that the people who were able to have good medical intervention, it may have been much lower, below 50%. But the people who were not able to have access to medical intervention, it could be as high as, 70 or 80%.
I mean, it's funny that we think below 50, like 50 is low.
It's no, yeah, definitely because below 50 is actually very high. So most, again, I shouldn't keep anthropomorphizing the virus, but it is not beneficial.
We decided it's Fred.
Yeah,
so.
Fred. It is not beneficial to kill off all your hosts. Like, so killing 80% of your potential people to spread to is not a good way to continue spreading in a population and thriving and a way to be a successful virus.
What's your take on the whole debate about whether or not viruses are living things?
Oh, I have a very strong opinion about this. So a lot of people, even virologists that I know, we had a big debate in our virology journal club in graduate school about this, and I'd say it was split, and probably more people classified them as non-living. But I tend to think of them as sort of, maybe I shouldn't admit this, but like the ultimate life form, which is why I describe them as exquisitely efficient. Because they have just evolved this way to live where they can use another life form to do almost everything they need to. And with the recent sort of discovery of these giant viruses, they basically have almost everything that host cells have. So I think it's becoming a little bit grayer as to whether or not they're living or dead, but I'm way more on the side that they're living.
Interesting. It's a whole fascinating discussion, and you get into some philosophical discussions about, you know,
I know,
what
I
is
like
life.
It. It's really interesting. Yeah. I don't know if we're prepared to go down.
No, I don't
path.
Think so. I think we need to read up a little bit about it. I got to refresh myself about Kant and all that stuff.
I'm going to go find my old philosophy books.
Exactly.
Instead of my science books. Nicole, this has been really interesting and really great. It's been really fun to have you on here and telling herpes jokes, because really, what other excuse do we need? So really, thanks so much for joining us and doing this.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Like our show? Find us on iTunes or at scopepodcast.com, and follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Moo Moo Shu
and Lindsay Claiborne.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycats. Thanks for listening.